Well, I'm in a multiply awkward situation here, being between everyone and their lunch, working on what maybe you all consider a contaminant, and I consider what you work on perhaps a contaminant to my work. And I went to the gym yesterday. I can barely move my arms today. So I'm just going to be like pointing like this kind of. But anyway, I'll try to be as direct as I can and get through this quickly, because I've been nicely set up by the talks the last couple of days. And I clearly need to make a new credits view graph, because my peculiar velocity is pretty high. And I have to keep crossing people out and saying where they're moving to. But the point to take away from this is this is a work of a collection of people. It's been a lot of hard work, and I want to give everyone due credit. But what I'm going to talk about today is measuring gas mass fractions from Sonyavsky-Soldovich effect observations. And these are the same observations that Eric has been using for his Hubble constant measurements. So he's already talked about Bimma and Hat Creek, and the setup is the same, the data are the same. So I won't go into that into any detail unless you have specific questions about that stuff, and then I will. But I won't spend time on that. So I guess the first question you want to ask is, why intercluster mass fractions? Intercluster medium mass fractions. Clusters are, you know, the most massive virilized structures we know about, for certain. You know, superclusters may be something that we need to talk about. But these are easily identifiable by many means that we've been talking about the last few days. But as such, we consider them a fair sample of the universe. So what clusters are made of should reflect the universal composition. So if we can measure the baryon fraction in clusters, we should have an indication of what the baryon fraction of the universe is. And obviously, that's an important parameter to know to input into all sorts of cosmological models. The intercluster medium is the dominant visible baryonic mass component in clusters. The galaxies contribute some order of magnitude less mass. We don't know for certain how much of the dark matter is baryonic, but indication is that it's not dominated by that phase. And cluster physics is relatively well understood. And that's something we argue about the details, but we know that these are massive structures and they're dominated by gravity, and this is hydrodynamics. And the details may be complicated, but the bulk physics of clusters is not wildly complicated. So here are the maps of some of the clusters. You've just seen these with Eric, but maybe I'll give you this, refresh you with the SC equation again. And I'll point you to the important bit of this for what I'm going to talk about. So this is the SC temperature decrement proportional to some constant, but times the integrated electron density through the line of sight. And so what we basically can do is, if we know the electron temperature, or we have a measured electron temperature, we can count up the electrons in the cluster. And if you know by the metallicity of the cluster the ratio of electrons to protons, you can count up the mass in baryons. So again, these are two-dimensional projections of the cluster mass distribution. So sort of at any point along the line of sight, we have sort of an integrated column density of electrons. So one thing you could do with this is say, I have the surface mass density, surface gas mass density of this cluster, a very good approximation of this. So if you wanted to know what fraction of the total mass this is, one obvious thing you could do is compare this to gravitational lensing, for instance, because gravitational lensing generally gives you the integrated total mass of a cluster. So that's probably the first thing you think of doing. And that's something that we've done, compared some of these gas masses to strong lensing measurements, and we've started to approach doing that to weak lensing measurements, but they're not widely available, and I had a thesis to write. So I decided to use an alternative method and use the whole beta model action that you've heard about in detail. So instead of just measuring the two-dimensional gas mass fraction, which you can do, instead I deprojected, which is recreating a three-dimensional model from the spatial information we have from the SC. So this spatial model, I should stress, is not derived from the X-ray information. The only X-ray information I use for this experiment is to get the electron temperature. So I use the spatial interferometric measurements we make to constrain a beta model, which is this, you know, power law index and core radius size, and deproject a three-dimensional model. And in this case, I've just assumed that the clusters are spherical, because as you allow using the elliptical information that we obviously have from those maps, it complicates things to a degree that makes it not very useful. So what I'm going to do is count on the fact that we have a lot of cluster observations and try to assume that the systematic due to cluster asphericity will come out in the end to be not significant if we use enough clusters. The other assumption I've made is that the cluster ICM is isothermal, and we know that, you know, in reality that's not completely true, but on the scales that I'm looking at, we have indications that that's a good approximation and that the systematics introduced by this assumption is not huge, and also that the gas is smooth and well approximated by a beta model. So what you can do from that is recreate the density structure of the gas. And if you assume that that gas is in hydrostatic equilibrium in the cluster potential, it's not very difficult to infer what the cluster potential is and recreate what the total mass is. So that's the hydrostatic mass. That's what I'll call the hydrostatic mass. And you get that as a function of radius. So Eric did a little bit of sleight of hand, and he showed you beta R core curves, which were mostly derived when the joint fitting occurs. Most of that fit is driven by the X-rays in the case that there's good X-ray observations. But using just the SC, you can't constrain the beta and R core of a cluster in particular very well. So this is, an X-ray astronomer is not going to be very impressed by these curves. And for the same reason, people that say, well, what's the beta and R core of this cluster from the SC? It's not really a very useful thing to say because I don't constrain that particularly well. But the saving grace of the experiment is that I don't have to. Because just as we were lucky with the Hubble constant, the contours of constant Hubble constant laid along the degeneracy of the beta R core. This is not the best representation. I wish I had it in color. I was fighting with the copier this morning. But say this is a beta R core curve, a particularly bad one. And the color scale tells you the constant mass. So this is proportional to the integrated surface mass of the cluster. You can't really see it here, but it luckily, if you choose this calculation at the right radius, so again, when I recreate these models, you have to integrate them out to a given radius. If you choose the radius to match where we're most sensitive with our observations, the contours of constant mass follow these beta core curves nicely. So although I don't know beta and R core, I know what the total mass is, and I know what the hydrostatic mass is. Now I'm just going to flip this up, and this view graph often generates more questions than it answers, but I just wanted to sort of explain how I do this calculation, since it's not necessarily what people normally do. But for each cluster, I have a sort of a three-dimensional fit. So I have a three-dimensional chi-squared space. So to the data, I have a fit in beta R core in the normalization, which is delta T over T. So for every point in that three-dimensional confidence space, I calculate the gas mass and I calculate the virial mass, and I calculate a gas fraction. And I plot those up as a function of confidence. So this is just an idea of how well we're measuring gas mass fractions. So this is for a spherical geometry. This is virial mass versus delta chi squared from the best fit. This is gas mass versus delta chi squared from the best fit. And this is a gas mass fraction. So this is at delta chi squared of 1, which is 68% confidence for one interesting parameter. That's how well we can measure the gas mass fraction under these assumptions. Okay, and there's one trick here. So if you want to know everything about one cluster, then measuring these gas mass fractions at a given radius that matches your instrument, and in our case, this is around a little bit over an arc minute, 65 arc seconds, that will give you some information. But if you remember, the clusters we're measuring go from redshift 0.15 to redshift 0.8. So a fixed angular scale of 65 arc seconds probes a very different part of the cluster, depending on what redshift you are. And if you want to do a sort of sample measurement and you want to compare clusters to each other, you want to measure the gas mass fraction at a fiducial radius. So the way cluster people generally parameterize clusters is their overdensity, their mass overdensity versus the critical density. So there's a trick I made, and I don't want you to look at this right now. That's more detail than you need to know, but this is the equation that I've been using to so I calculate the gas mass fractions within 65 arc seconds for each of these clusters, and I calculate what overdensity that is, and there's a small correction that you can make that's calibrated by numerical simulations from Everard et al. And compared with real X-ray observations that will tell you how that gas mass fraction within your radius compares to the overdensity, gas mass fraction within an overdensity of 500, which is near the Vero radius. So I've taken all of these measurements and calibrated them out to the same fiducial radius. This correction is at max about 30% and normally around 10%. So it's, I'm not doubling my measurements or anything here, but I wanted to at least include this fact that I know that I'm not measuring in the same place. So I'll go through, before I give you the result, I'll just quickly run through the main sources of systematic uncertainty in this measurement. Again, I'm really relying heavily on knowing the electron temperature very well. The gas mass fraction is proportional to the inverse square of this, so a 10% error in this is really actually kind of a killer. That's something that we can resolve with Chandra and XMM. We're in the regime now where we can actually start to measure these with high accuracy. And I'll talk about this. I saved, 10 minutes to talk about the new Chandra observations, so I'll go into that into a little bit more detail. In the unresolved temperature structure, that's something we can actually now observe and see and test and calibrate the simulations. Again, so this hydrostatic equilibrium approximation, we'd like to believe that this is a good approximation, and in bulk it probably is, but that's something you would want to test because we know that clusters merge and clusters are forming, and how long does it take before this gas is in a reasonable potential. That's something you can test by comparing the total mass you calculate to the total mass calculated not under those assumptions, so you can compare to lensing observations, for instance. Also, that correction factor, it was not derived from simulations that were really designed to do that correction, because we're right in the cores of clusters, so that might be something that can be improved in the future. And again, the cluster geometry, as I said, doing this work on a large sample of clusters probably takes care of that. Okay, so here I'm plotting the 18 clusters that I observed. The ordinate here is temperature, and the clusters that we've observed range from 5 to approximately 13. So from all that we know, clusters that are massive, which we define as greater than 5 keV, should not have lost a lot of their gas due to preheating or supernova or anything like that. So we shouldn't see a systematic, if we've done this experiment and chosen our clusters correctly, we shouldn't see a systematic change with temperature, and here we don't. One thing, though, if cluster gas mass fractions are indeed the same in all clusters, if you choose your cosmology incorrectly and calculate your distance according to the wrong cosmology, you might see a systematic change with redshift. And I've chosen, actually, the plotted here using an omega matter equals 0.3, omega lambda equals 0, and I believe that the universe is probably flat, so this is probably not the right cosmology, but again, we don't have good enough statistical uncertainties to really have any handle on that. So what I'm showing here is the lack of ability to resolve that question, but that's something in the future that you might want to do. Okay, so here are the results. So for the sample, the total sample for 18 clusters, the gas mass fraction at that cosmology I said, the one that nobody really particularly likes, is about 7.5%. And I use a Hubble constant of 100, so scale that to your favorite number. For a more reasonable cosmology, though, a flat universe with omega matter equals 0.3, it's a little bit higher. It's about 8%. So that's for the 18 clusters. If you want to try to get rid of your dependence on cosmology and your dependence on calculating the distance right, what I did was chose the lowest redshift clusters in my sample, just below redshift of 0.25. And so there's still maybe a 5% dependence on cosmology in the distances here, but that's still within my statistical errors. So the statistics on these is worse, but using the low redshift clusters, which should not have cosmology in this number, get about 7.5%. Actually more like 9%. So this is the kind of measurement you'd want to do cosmology with. So this is, if you ask me, what do I think the best measurement of the gas mass fraction from this work is to calculate omega matter, this is the one I would use. So if we believe that we know omega baryon, and now we have some discussion on this, but I would say that I'm really encouraged by the fact that you can measure omega baryon calculating atomic cross-sections and using Big Bang nucleosynthesis, and you could go off and build your own CMB machine and calculate omega baryon and get so close to it. I would say that's really good news rather than a problem. So we know omega baryon to some accuracy. That's pretty good. So what I can measure is the baryon fraction in cluster, and what somebody can tell me is what omega baryon is. Then I can solve for what I think omega matter would be. And this is an upper limit again, because I can always put in the galaxies. I can always put in what I estimate the baryonic dark matter is. So an upper limit on omega matter is about 0.25 from this experiment at 65% confidence. And if I throw in my best estimates of what I think the galaxies will contribute and how many baryon clusters lost in the formation process, that's that sort of epsilon parameter people were talking about, and assume a number for the Hubble constant of 0.7, then I'd say my best estimate of omega matter is 0.3. And again, I find that really encouraging because this is not a geometrical measurement. This is simply counting up baryons. And this seems to be in the same ballpark as you measure omega matter from geometrical considerations. So, and cluster abundances. Most people get this number from cluster abundances. So I'm also going to compare that to the other work that's been done. Joe measured the gas mass fraction for a set of current EPIC clusters using the X-ray measurements, and he gets about. And do note that the Hubble constant dependence is different when you measure with X-rays because the emission measure is different. And you get 7.5% at this cosmology. And Steve also measured the gas mass fraction using SC and X-ray shape parameters and gets, we're also consistent with this within our very generous error bars. So we don't see any evidence for a huge systematic offset that you might expect if you had large clumping factors or a serious error in your analysis. So the next things we plan to do to improve this work is to use better temperatures, finish up the sample, use the rest of the clusters. We're hoping that the SC interferometer should improve drastically in the future. It'd be great to have the new arrays going. Use numerical simulations to test the systematic errors that we think might be in the analysis or see what they might contribute. And use all the rest of the information we know about clusters, lensing, velocity dispersions to get a handle on what we think might be going on in a particular cluster. And so I'm going to spend just a couple of minutes to talk about, I'm changing gears, and talk about a project going on, a guaranteed time project using the Chandra Observatory. I've moved now over to go to be an X-ray astronomer in some degree. And I thought it would be much easier to be in the image plane, but it turns out really not to be any less complicated than interferometry. But there, Liam van Spaebroek is a telescope scientist for Chandra and was largely responsible for the mirror being so beautifully accurate as it was, and sort of adds part of his program, being a guaranteed time observer for his contributions. He's decided to observe the same clusters that have been in our SC project using his guaranteed time, which is a huge chunk of time, by the way. This is an indication. So in AO1, he observed using 760 kiloseconds of time. AO2, 500 kiloseconds. And for the following years of the lifetime of the instrument, every year he'll be observing 250 kiloseconds of clusters. So there's a lot of hope that we can start to clean up some of the ambiguities we've had using ROSAT. It's constructed to measure cosmological parameters combining X-ray and SC. So it's chosen very specifically to look at the same SC clusters, to choose clusters in a sufficient number that we can beat down the systematics we know are going to be there. And these clusters will all be observable by the current SC interferometers so that the right declinations, and we chose to make sure that they don't have point sources. The expected yield of this is 60% clusters will be usable, and as we learn more about clusters, that will certainly go up or down. Who knows? Oh, here are, just to mention, people that are currently involved with this project, which will certainly grow and change. Leon is the GTO here. And so, what I'll talk about is this cluster MS1137 that we've mentioned in the last two talks. This cluster, well, here's a quick look here. It's a redshift 0.78, so one of the highest redshift clusters we know about that's really massive. So we're getting to know that there are more clusters of high redshifts, but clusters that are incredibly massive like this, we expect to be rare. This was observed for 120 kiloseconds, so one of the longest times, observation times you're really going to ever have on a cluster. It's pretty unlikely that if you proposed on your own, you would get more time than this, and it's pretty unlikely that a guaranteed time observer would spend more than this. So this will be sort of an upper limit on how well you're going to do on high redshift clusters, most likely. It was observed with ASCA and gave a temperature of 5.7 keV with very large error bars. Has a very, compact core radius, about 15 arc seconds. And Keck spectroscopy suggests that it's sort of a regular cluster. Lensing observation suggests it's also regular and compact. Garrett showed the images from Doug Clough's paper that show it to have perhaps filaments, although I'm not sure about the signal to noise and all that. But from what we know in the lensing observation, the strong lenses in the core, it looks very compact and symmetric. And so I call it a golden cluster, thinking that we have a high redshift, very massive, very observable, round cluster, long observations. This is about as good as you're going to do to do cosmology at high redshifts for now. Sorry? 3 minutes? Okay. So just a quick look at, this is, I find it really remarkable. This is non-background subtracted, just binned. This is what you get right off of Chandra, and it's pretty impressive. This half arc second resolution, this is a really high redshift cluster. We don't see stuff like this. So I measure here's a look at what the spectrum of the entire cluster looks like. This is background subtracted. You clearly see an iron line here. And you can measure its temperature. I get a slightly higher temperature, something more like 7.5 or 7.2 keV. And you can also constrain the abundance of this redshift, which is pretty remarkable. I think it's probably the highest redshift cluster that you can constrain the abundance this well, and it looks to be about 0.4. I think I'll just carry this with me. We also fit the cluster. This is what it used to look like, the beta R core curve used to look like when you had to fit it with ROSAT data. And this is not exactly fair because it's not quite the same axis ranges, but this is the beta R core constraints you get using that Chandra observation. So again, it's a very compact cluster. Its core radius is about 11 arc seconds. So it's good that we have these high-resolution instruments now that we can actually measure these things. And actually, one last quick thing about this cluster. If you plot the... it's about as spherical as you want. You allow it to be elliptical and says, I'm not interested. I'm really spherical. Don't bother. So this is a one-dimensional... This is a one-dimensional profile of... Oh, they do. They don't talk to you, Steve? So this is a 1D brightness profile, surface brightness profile, and this red line is the best fit beta model. And just in the center, you can see, if I could lift my arm higher, you could see the central brightness kind of exceeds what you're expecting from this given beta model. And so I calculated what the cooling time is at the cluster center, and it's just about the Hubble time. So you can imagine this is a cluster that hasn't undergone a recent merger, and it might just be starting to cool, its cooling flow, but it's not big enough to really disturb the temperature and the luminosity. It might be, again, sort of the nicest cluster to cosmology you can see because it's relaxed, symmetrical, and just hasn't undergone a recent merger. And you might also say, everyone says, oh, a spherical cluster, that must be in projection. It must be a cigar-long line of sight. It's going to be terrible, which it might be. Who knows? But is one way to test that. I calculated the virial mass. I calculated the surface total mass using my hydrostatic equilibrium approximation, and I compared that to the weak lensing mass. at the same radius, and they agree quite well within the errors. If we had a very large, long cigar-like thing, you might expect that these wouldn't agree at all, because I've assumed, in the HSC approximation, I've assumed it's a spherical cluster. So this is starting to suggest that maybe this isn't as bad as you might want it to be. And just a quick, there are some aspect problems. We've been claiming that most of our clusters in the SC overlap the X-rays. There is a residual aspect error problem in the Chandra data that I'm not convinced is taken out of this data, so I don't know that this offset between the two is real. But this is the Chandra data again, and this is the Hat Creek SE. Overo contours laid over it. And you can see these high redshifts. The SC is a better way to probe out to large radii just because, you know, it doesn't fall off quite as fast. For nearby clusters, it isn't as dramatically apparent as it is here. I'm sorry? That's a good question. These are two point sources. I don't know that they've been identified. That might be why the temperature is different from the OSCA temperature, because you can't take these out in an OSCA observation. And when I take these out, or when I leave these in and compare to the temperature, having taken them out, you get a temperature half a keV lower. So at high redshifts, it's fairly important to have a high, have good angular resolution to get an accurate temperature. Yeah. I think that improving the astrometry won't be hard. I just didn't have time to do it before I left a few weeks ago. So I'd like to have some before I say that this is real offset, I'd like to have some confidence in the astrometry. But actually, I don't know if these are identified optically or not, but they're quite bright in the X-ray, so we'll see. And that's basically where the X-ray side of things stands. And hopefully in, you know, months' time, certainly in a year's time, we'll have improved gas mass fractions and Hubble constants using Chandra data, and that's the goal. And that's all I have for you.